Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Stuttered Kennedy. Chapter 47. The Next Friend's Suit. The New York world in the first decade of the century was a great institution. It dominated the field of journalism in the United States, and Joseph Pulitzer completely dominated the world. His word was law, and he exacted and received willingly from the world men a loyalty and devotion seldom, if ever, equaled in similar circumstances. He could not afford to lie under the stigma of having allowed his paper to trump up a case reflecting on a woman and upon the religion of a large body of people, and based on nothing more substantial than, as his critics insisted, a desire for sensationalism. It was a new thing to Joseph Pulitzer to be thus called to account, and to find himself with nothing to say in his defense. He must confound his enemies somehow, and it seems to have been clear to him from the first that whatever action he took would have to be such as to compel circumstances rather than any open and direct action on his part to produce his vindication. Joseph Pulitzer's immense driving force had got him much that he wanted in his early days. This same force, plus almost unlimited resources, seemed in his later years capable of getting him literally anything he wanted and enabled him to make or unmake anyone he pleased. He still firmly believed that most of the charges he had brought against Mrs. Eddy and her household were true, and he was determined that they should, somehow or other, be substantiated. And so he set about it. There was nothing to show for some time, and then in its issue for March 2, 1907, the world announced that a petition had been made to the courts of New Hampshire by Mary Baker Eddy, who sues by her next friends, George W. Glover and George W. Baker, against Calvin A. Fry, Alfred Farlow, Irving C. Tomlinson, Ira O. Knapp, William B. Johnson, Stephen A. Chase, Joseph Armstrong, Edward A. Kimball, Herman S. Herring, and Lewis C. Strang, to compel them to give an accounting of her property, to make restitution if it should be proved that they were in any way in default, and to enjoin them, while the suit was pending, from receiving or disposing of any funds. They further prayed the court to appoint a receiver to take possession of Mrs. Eddy's estate. As far as the outside world was concerned, neither Joseph Pulitzer nor his paper had anything to do with the move. That the world should give prominence to it, to news which seemed to indicate a development tending towards the justification of its contentions in regard to Mrs. Eddy and the Christian Science movement, was only natural. Hence, when it devoted several columns in its issue of March 2nd to the story of the case, no one was surprised, and no other newspaper had the temerity to suggest that such full reporting had anything to do with a connection of the world with the case. Indeed, so complete was Pulitzer's hold on the press at that time that never once during the long, drawn-out legal proceedings which followed was such connection openly averred. It was hinted at often enough, but that was as far as it ever got. Pulitzer had laid his plans carefully, and the story is an interesting one. On a cold winter day in the latter part of 1906, a traveler of unmistakable New York cut alighted from the train at Lead City, South Dakota. There was nothing unusual in that. Lead City in 1906 was enjoying the great mining boom in its history. Gold was being brought into the town from the snow-clad Black Hills at the rate of $5 million a year. And the huge mining plant of the Homestake Mine was rapidly becoming one of the largest in the world. New York was much interested, and there was much traffic back and forth between the two cities. This particular traveler, however, had no interest in mining, although the driver of the hackney which he hired at the station might have so assumed, for he asked to be driven to the house of a well-known mining prospector in the city, one George Glover. George Glover at that time was well settled in a comfortable home which his mother, Mrs. Eddy, had built for him some years previously, and was energetically seeking to secure that share in the boom which always somehow evaded his grasp. Mrs. Eddy had from time to time given him money for his mining ventures, but he was in chronic need of capital. $5,000 to secure a share in something that was absolutely beyond question. $30,000 to erect a new quartz mill, which for many years to come would secure unlimited business. These are some of the things mentioned in his letters to his mother about this time. And so, when a traveler from New York was landed at his door and announced his desire to discuss a very private and confidential matter, he was, no doubt, filled with pleasurable expectancy. The traveler introduced himself as Mr. James Slott of New York, and after warning George Glover that his mission was highly confidential, and being assured by the latter that his confidence would be respected, and that he might speak with the utmost frankness, Mr. Slott at once went on to explain that he came from the New York world, that the world, in spite of all the statements to the contrary which had appeared broadcast in the press, was convinced that its charges in regard to the condition and treatment of Mrs. Eddy were true. Mr. Slott insisted to George that it had no quarrel whatever with Mrs. Eddy, that the whole purpose of its disclosures was to save a woman who in her day had deserved well of her fellows, from falling in her old age into the hands of designing people, who sought to seize and dissipate a fortune which rightly belonged, in large part, at any rate, to George Glover himself. George was impressed. He evidently, as subsequent correspondence disclosed, found it difficult at first to believe that his mother was dominated mentally by anyone. But when Mr. Slott went on to dilate upon the enormous proportions of his mother's estate, how that the world had reckoned its net value at no less than $15 million, and that the income approximated $1 million a year, George, no doubt, asking himself what he could not do with a 20th of such a sum, began to have his doubts. At the right moment, Mr. Slott produced a letter from Senator Chandler of New Hampshire. George knew him, of course, by reputation, and as he commenced to read the letter, he could see that it was most friendly in tone. Dated Washington, D.C., November 22, 1906, it ran, "My dear Mr. Glover, I have consented to act as legal counsel concerning questions which arise in connection with Mrs. Mary Baker G. Eddy. They are stated in a letter from me to Mr. Slott, who will call upon you and show you my letter to him. It is important for public and private interests that these questions should be investigated and met and fairly and justly disposed of as questions involving doubts, which, from large and commendable motives, all good citizens, and especially all relatives of Mrs. Eddy, should help to solve and settle. Therefore, please be sure and give Mr. Slott a full hearing, and possess yourself fully of all the facts which he will be able to give you. Very respectfully, signed, William E. Chandler." As soon as George had finished reading, the adroit Mr. Slott had the letter referred to, ready, and handed it over. The senator came at once to the point. Writing to Slott from Washington, under date November 22, 1906, he said, "My dear Mr. Slott, I consent to act as counsel concerning certain questions which arise in connection with Mrs. Mary Baker G. Eddy. It seems that there are several doubts about several points. 1. Mrs. Eddy may be detained in the custody of strangers against her will. 2. She may be so nearly worn out in body and mind as a confirmed invalid that she is incapable of deciding any questions whatever, according to any will or pleasure of her own, and necessarily, therefore, incapable of managing her business and property affairs. 3. Being thus restrained or incapable, or without relatives near her, she may be surrounded by designing men who either have already sought or may hereafter seek to wrongfully possess themselves of her large property, or induce her to make a disposition of it contrary to what would be her sane and deliberate intentions if she were in perfect possession of her liberty and mental faculties. These doubts have arisen in connection with investigations recently made. Beyond all question, steps should be taken to solve the doubts, to correct the wrong, if it exists, and to establish the right in every respect. This new work should be done, if possible, in cooperation with Mrs. Eddy's son or any other relative who may be impressed with his duties in this regard. And if the relatives do not move, it should be done by such right-minded citizens as are in sympathy with the commendable movement. Yours truly, William E. Chandler. It is not surprising that in the circumstances, George Glover was easily won over. And when told that his cousin, George W. Baker, only son of George Sullivan Baker, of the far-off days in Sandbutton Bridge, had decided to join in the petition, he consented to take the lead, and shortly afterwards, on the advice of Senator Chandler, he set out with his daughter, Mary, for Washington. Meanwhile, in Concord, there was no thought of what was coming. The popular condemnation of the world's attack in October had been so emphatic and complete that it looked as if Mrs. Eddy and her household might reasonably look forward to some measure of peace in the immediate future. And then, one day, just before Christmas, Mrs. Eddy, to her surprise, received a letter from George from Lead City, telling her he was just setting out for Washington with his daughter Mary, and that they looked forward to seeing her in Concord before they returned home. He said nothing as to the purpose of his visit to Washington. And immediately on receipt of his letter, Mrs. Eddy sent word for him to come to Concord as soon as he could, and telling him that although they had not room for him and Mary at Pleasant View, she had arranged for them to be guests in the home of one of her friends in Concord. On the advice of Senator Chandler, George, in his reply, did not set any date for his visit. But on January 2nd, he and Mary went up to Concord unannounced. Mrs. Eddy received them at once, and although, as written up in the World 3 months later, she was again pictured as in the depths of senile decay, subsequent testimony was abundant to show that such allegations were untrue to the point of absurdity. There was as yet, however, no word of the contemplated suit, and the announcement in the World, as already quoted, broke on the little household in Concord quite unexpectedly. The petition of the next friends, as published practically verbatim in the World, was a formidable document, and indicated an investigation as to the property and position of Mrs. Eddy, such as could only have been achieved as the result of the expenditure of much time and resources. The charges amounted to the same as those advanced in the notorious articles in the World some 6 months previously, namely, that Mrs. Eddy was mentally incapable, was kept a virtual prisoner in Pleasant View, and that there was reason to suppose that those who had her in custody were dissipating or misappropriating her property. The petition then went on to set forth the alleged character and worth of this property in detail, going back over the years to Mrs. Eddy's first classes, and setting forth exactly how much she received from each. The income from her books and the computed value of the Journal and the Sentinel and the Mother Church as a going concern were all set down, and the whole concluded with the usual prayer that the defendants be required to disclose and give an account, be restrained from further action, and that a receiver or receivers be appointed. Mrs. Eddy felt it all keenly, especially the fact that the leader in the attack should be her own son. But in moments of crisis, she had found that she had to take the lead. Those around her might strive valiantly to solve this problem and that, but if they could not do it, the burden in the end devolved upon her. It had been the case when she first embarked on her self-appointed task in middle life. It was the same when she was 86. From a legal point of view, she had always been singularly well advised, and this was certainly the case in regard to the next friend's suit. General Frank Streeter, who immediately took charge of matters, was a distinguished and resourceful lawyer, and his first act was little short of an inspiration. He advised Mrs. Eddy to turn over her entire estate to three trustees of her own choosing, and give them paramount power to manage her affairs. In this way, the sole question which would be before the court when the case came up for trial would be whether or not Mrs. Eddy, at the time of granting the trusteeship, was mentally capable. Accordingly, on March 6, 1907, Mrs. Eddy signed a deed of trust, which gave ownership of property in trust to three individuals: Archibald McClellan, editor-in-chief of her publications and periodicals; Josiah E. Fernald, president of one of the Concord banks; and Henry M. Baker, a cousin and a lawyer. From the moment that the petition was formally filed and the inevitable trial of the case in the newspapers had begun, it became clear that time was going to be on the side of the aged woman at Pleasant View. The press in the country was thoroughly roused. Newspapers everywhere that had told the world just what they thought of its policies and methods some 6 months previously had no intention of allowing the world to prove itself right and themselves wrong without a struggle. Newspaper correspondents flocked to Concord with urgent petitions that they might be allowed to interview Mrs. Eddy. And in several notable instances, the request was granted. William E. Curtis of the Chicago Record Herald, Edwin J. Park of the Boston Globe, Arthur Brisbane of the New York Evening Journal, all went to Pleasant View and came away with the same story, that instead of the mental and physical derelict they had been assured was held in durance vile, they had found a woman physically and mentally phenomenal, whose people were absolutely devoted to her, who selected the food for her table, supervised the work of her retainers, and took the keenest interest in the disposition of all her affairs and belongings. The idea that this strong-minded woman, declared impatiently yet another interviewer, Dr. Alan McLean Hamilton, is ever a victim of coercion is manifestly absurd. Of these journalists and others who interviewed Mrs. Eddy at Pleasant View in the early summer of 1907, while the next friend's suit was awaiting the convenience of the courts, the record of Arthur Brisbane is perhaps the most remarkable. Arthur Brisbane, at this time, was in his early 40s. He was editor of the New York Evening Journal and was rapidly coming to the front as an able, if somewhat ruthless, journalist. He was the last man in the world to commit himself to statements which he knew might well be disproved within a few weeks. He went to Pleasant View, as he admits himself, full of prejudice. But from the first, he seems to have been captivated by what he found there. His first glimpse of the house, a very pleasant, quiet abode, on the side of a most beautiful New Hampshire valley. The brightness and light to be found everywhere. The Christian Science ladies with peaceful, happy expressions, who greeted him so kindly. One of them came forward to say, "Mrs. Eddy is very glad that you have come and will see you. Please come into her sitting room." She led the way upstairs into a corner room at the rear of the house with wide windows overlooking the valley and the distant hills. Beside a writing desk, in an armchair, sat a white-haired woman, who rose and walked forward, extending her hand in friendly greeting to a stranger. That was Mrs. Eddy, for whom many human beings in this world feel deepest reverence and affection, and concerning whom others have thought it necessary or excusable to write and say unkind and untruthful things. It is quite certain that nobody could see this beautiful and venerable woman and ever again speak of her except in terms of affectionate reverence and sympathy. There are hundreds of thousands of Christian scientists who would make almost any sacrifice for the privilege of looking on Mrs. Eddy's face. It is impossible now for her to see many, and it is therefore a duty to make at least an attempt to convey an idea of the impression created by her personality. And then Arthur Brisbane goes on to paint his picture. It is easy to see that his heart is in his task. Mrs. Eddy is 86 years old. Her thick hair, now snow white, curls about her forehead and temples. She is of medium height and very slender. but her figure is straight as she rises and walks forward. The grasp of her thin hand is firm. The hand does not tremble. It is hopeless to describe a face made beautiful by age, deep thought, and many years' exercise of power. The light blue eyes are strong and concentrated in expression, and the sight, as was soon proved, is that of a woman half Mrs. Eddy's age. Mrs. Eddy's face is almost entirely free from wrinkles. The skin is very clear. Many a young woman would be proud to have it. The forehead is high and full, and the whole expression of the face combines benevolence with great strength of will. Mrs. Eddy has accumulated power in this world. She possesses it. She exercises it. And she knows it. But it is a gentle power, and it is possessed by a gentle, diffident, and modest woman. Women will want to know what Mrs. Eddy wore. The writer regrets he cannot tell. With some women, you see the dress. With Mrs. Eddy, you see only the face. She wore a lace collar, no jewelry of any kind, and a simple dress. That much is remembered. With that good journalistic sense, which in later years enabled him to scale dizzy and uncertain peaks in his profession, Arthur Brisbane then goes on, faithfully, to cover the whole ground. He fills in his picture, which he evidently designs to be a full-length portrait, not only of the woman, but of her surroundings also. He records how she pointed out the beautiful view to him from her study window, how she spoke simply of her own life and work, and of her absolute happiness in her peaceful surroundings. How she discussed business matters with him for over half an hour with equal interest and without any sign of flagging. And in the turn of his sentences, he manages to convey quite accurately that sweeping away of prejudice, which seems to have been a characteristic effect on many people who visited Mrs. Eddy. He asked her to read aloud to him a passage of his own selection, and later declares that among young public speakers, there are few with voices stronger, deeper, than the voice of Mrs. Eddy at 86. She read the ordinary magazine type without glasses, as readily as any woman of 25 could do, and with great power of expression and understanding. Finally, in describing their leave-taking, he writes, "Her face, so remarkably young, framed in beautiful snow-white hair, and supported by the delicate, frail, erect body, seemed really the personification of that victory over matter to which her religion aspires."